Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. The coolest thing about my job is the incredible people that I get to meet and that I get to call my friends. And my guest today is one of those incredibly amazing souls by the name of Ben Azadi, who I get to call my friend and I get to interview on my very own podcast. I'm so excited for you guys to hear this episode. Ben Azadi has been around for, well, over a decade and changing people's lives year in, year out, day in, day out. So I'm really excited for you to listen to this episode. Before I do that, of course, I would love to thank you for being here, as always, for raising this podcast to new heights every month. And also would love to invite you to check out natnittam.com, where you can learn about the community. You can learn about, sign up for my newsletter. And also there's a peptide newsletter. So many things to discover on that website. So definitely check it out if you get a second. If you have less than a second, but you know that you know someone who would get benefit from this episode, please make sure to share it with them because you never know, you might just change someone's life. All right, let's thank a couple of sponsors and then let's jump in with Ben Azadi. I'm probably not teaching you anything by saying that life is full of challenges that demand your energy. Early mornings, busy schedules, and keeping up with everything life throws your way. From long commutes to overflowing inboxes, not to mention keeping up with the news, it's easy to feel depleted. But what if you could stay energized and resilient no matter what comes your way? What if you could recharge as fast as life drains you? That's exactly what Quantum Upgrade does. Imagine plugging yourself into a limitless power source. It's been rigorously tested and shown to improve blood flow, reduce stress, and even boost cellular energy by up to 29%. So you get to try it out yourself today for free at quantumupgrade.io/nat and start running life instead of life running you. Now, if you use that code NAT15, you get a 15-day free trial on the all-in-one frequency bundle, good through June 1st, 2025. So once again, that's quantumupgrade.io/NAT and make sure you use code NAT15 so that instead of their usual 7-day free trial, you get a 15-day free trial. Check it out. If you've ever cut calories, ramped up your workouts, and still couldn't lose that little bit of extra weight, or even a lot of extra weight, this episode is definitely for you. Today, I'm talking to my dear friend, Ben Azadi, founder of Keto Camp and author of Metabolic Freedom, about what's really going on when the scale just won't budge. You'll learn why the calories in, calories out model fails so many people, how to actually support your metabolism instead of slowing it down and beating yourself up, and why strategic carb days can actually help with fat loss. This conversation is packed with practical tools for creating metabolic flexibility, the ultimate goal, folks, avoiding common keto mistakes and taking back control of your health. So Ben is inviting you, the audience, to pre-order or purchase his new book, Metabolic Freedom, by going to metabolicfreedombook.com and enter your order info and receive a free bonus course on metabolism on him. If you're one of these biohackers that loves doing these NF1 experiments with peptides, I have got amazing news for you. We all know that managing a peptide protocol should feel intentional, not improvised. And when you're working with multiple peptides in your experiments, timing and precision matter. Whether you're new to peptides or a seasoned biohacker, tracking manually leaves way too much room for missed doses, overlaps, or even inefficiencies. The Peptide Pro app can help manage every part of your protocol. From smart scheduling to real-time dose checklists, it keeps things organized and on track. You can even log notes and adjust protocols as you go. Beyond the tracking, what sets Peptide Pro apart is its comprehensive calculator and quick reference guide. You can input your target protocol and immediately see how many vials you'll need with microgram and milligram conversions done for you. No spreadsheets and no second guessing. And if you want to expand your peptide knowledge, Peptide Pro gives you instant access to a robust database of over 65 small molecules. Listeners of this podcast, get this, can receive 50% off for the first month subscription. All you have to do is go to peptidepro.app to download the app and use code Natalie50 to get started today. Now for Natalie50, there's an H in there. Don't forget. So it's N-A-T-H-A-L-I-E 50 to get started today. Welcome to the show, Ben Ezzati. It is such a pleasure to have you here today.
I'm excited to be back, and you're in the forest. It's in the wilderness
here. Okay. Not the most flattering, but funny story, guys, is that if you're watching this on YouTube, you may notice that I've been in the woods lately. The reason for that is because I was playing with the backgrounds on my recording software and it got stuck.
So Natalie's stuck out in the wilderness.
You know what? Frankly, in the grand scheme of the world, it's not a bad place to be. It's sunny and warm and the beautiful leaves on the trees. I mean, I only wish I was in the forest right now. So here I am. But Ben, you have a new book out, which means that everybody's about to get healthier, right? So thank you for doing that, for doing all that you do. I'm excited to dive into the book with you and share your wisdom with the audience. And I'm going to kick this off with a little story. And it's so funny because this happened at the gym not two mornings ago. And when I got the documents from your team, the first thing that they're saying, you know, one of the things you might want to talk to Ben about is the whole paradigm of calories in, calories out. And so I'm at the gym and a lot of people at my gym don't necessarily know who I am or what I do. And there's a young, really helpful, lovely trainer. And he's talking to a man, I would say this man is maybe 30 years old, not an old guy, extremely overweight. And, you know, he's that really, really overweight guy that just comes to the gym and there's a lot of things he can't do, but he's in there and he's working hard and it's amazing. And I'm not meaning to, but I'm overhearing the conversation where, you know, this trainer very earnestly says to him, look, I mean, if you want to change the way you look, and I'm waiting, and he goes, all you got to do is like expend more energy than you're taking in. And I'm like, no. And then he goes on to say, look, I mean, just 5,000 steps a day, like you just 5,000 steps a day and you'll be good. You'll be good. And I'm sitting there as nutritionist / podcast / all the other things that I am saying, you know, there's a possibility that that's not the worst advice. If we know that he's eating enough, if we know that he hasn't been crash dieting for the last 10, 15 years and destroyed his metabolism, if all of those things are true, but otherwise put someone in a situation where they're kind of they're bound to lose. And I just find that it was so hard for me not to just jump in and say, yeah, get out of the way.
Yeah, let me take over.
Go lift some weights. I'll talk to you later. Anyway, I'd love to kick this off because so much of what you've written about in the book is about these misconceptions that just won't die. And so yeah, let's just start there because I think that it's a tenet of a healthy body weight that just won't die. And do you want to talk about this a little bit?
I do. Yeah, it's perfect that you just went through that. And unfortunately, it happens all the time. You know, I was like that personal trainer because I used to be a personal trainer. And that's exactly what I told my clients. Hey, yeah, Eat less, move more. Let's get you in a deficit. It makes sense. It really does on paper. Like, yeah, if you just expend more energy than you consume and you create a deficit, that's 3,500 calories. That's about 1 pound of fat. You continue to do that until you achieve your goal body weight. It makes sense on paper, but when you actually apply it, it's a whole different story. And let me first say that calories do matter. They're just not the most important thing. They're a distraction. So this trainer was distracting this client. He wanted to do good. I like the recommendation for 5,000 steps. I mean, that's fine. But to just say, hey, we need to get you to expend more than you consume, it's not the whole story. And the premise this trainer has, and still people to this day who follow that method, their premise is this, Natalie. I need to get you to lose weight in order for you to be healthy. Mm-hmm. But the body does not lose weight to get healthy. We get healthy to lose weight. There's no mechanisms in place in the body that count calories. We're not a bank account or a math equation or a calculator. We're a very complex chemistry lab. And as a matter of fact, that guy that you referenced that was in the gym, the 30-year-old guy who was overweight, he does not have a weight problem. If you're overweight right now, you do not have a weight problem. I used to be obese. I never had a weight problem. It's a weight symptom. Mm. When you just focus on when you are only focusing on calories, you're focusing on treating the symptom. The real cause is hormones and cell inflammation. That's where the focus should be. And there are two studies I put in Metabolic Freedom where I discussed this in chapter one. And that's one study was on The Biggest Loser, which is a TV show. It was a TV show in the US where they had these morbidly obese individuals. You remember it, right?
Oh my God. It was so bad.
Yeah. They put them on.
It was so good, but it was so bad.
It was entertaining, right? And they put them on these calorie deficits, exercised them, similar to what this trainer recommended. They lost a lot of weight and they celebrated them on this final episode. And this one study followed up with 14 of those contestants and it showed that 13 out of the 14 contestants gained all the weight back, and a portion of them gained even more weight before they started the show. Not only that, they measured their hormones like ghrelin, the hunger hormone, which is through the roof now. They measured their satiety fat-burning hormone leptin. It had plummeted. They had destroyed their metabolism. This is why there's never a Biggest Loser reunion show. Another study came out showing the connection between the gut microbiome and weight loss. And it had two groups in this study. Everybody in the study was obese. One, they were both controlling their calories. They were monitoring their calories. One group had a fecal microbial transplant from lean, healthy donors. Yep. The other group did not. So with this group that got the fecal microbial transplant, it repopulated their gut bacteria, created more diversity. They started to lose weight without any dietary changes, showing you that it's the gut, different factors that play here. But if you just focused on the calories, that you wouldn't see the full picture. And just one more thing. The challenge with the calories in versus calories out method is that it usually works in the beginning.
It does. As a first intervention, right?
Yeah. And it usually does work for most people in the beginning. But then the weight stalls. The weight does come off for most people when you start to go into a deficit. But then what happens? It starts to stall. And most people think, well, we need to just exercise more or cut more or do a combination of both. And then you lose some weight and then it stalls. Then you could only cut so much until the metabolism just goes into the survival mode where it starts to really slow down and starts to become inefficient. And the metabolism doesn't even run in speeds. It's either efficient or inefficient. So we're not trying to create a fast metabolism. We're not trying to fix a slow metabolism. We're trying to create a healthy, flexible metabolism. And that's the goal the thing that I try to come across in the book, the plan, I should say, that I try to implement in the book.
Yeah. I love that you talk about metabolic flexibility, and we're going to get into that. And I do think that, you know, when I was working as a nutritionist, I would say that there were almost as many people who were starving themselves as there were people who were overfeeding. And it's heartbreaking because they're in a race to the bottom. And the body, you know, you imagine the body as a 3-year-old toddler crossing its arms going, no, no, nope, 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 this is not working. And what the body's doing, it's working for you. Our bodies are working for us based on the information that they have, which is limited, and it has very specific filters, right? Are we in a place that we can survive? And what do I need to do to make sure that we survive to fight another day or to live another day? And we would argue that people who carry more body fat naturally, probably from an ancestral perspective, would have been the survivors. Mm-hmm. You know, the scrawny people would die off at the first sign of famine.
Yeah.
So, but when we're talking about people who are clinically obese, this is now no longer a a survival adaptation. This is now we're moving into a dysregulation of the systems that are meant to keep us in balance. Yeah. And I love that you said that at the beginning it works, because it can work at the beginning. I feel like there's such a loss of nuance so often in this conversation where people say, well, calories in, calories out doesn't work. And if you leave it at that, there's going to be people in the audience who are going, dude, I did it. It worked for me. Right? But I can tell you there's going to be 30 other people who said, yeah, I did it once and it worked for me. But I think you know Joel Green. And yeah. Joel Green talks about every up and down on that yo-yo that you're on, losing and gaining weight, losing and gaining weight. Every time you lose and gain and lose and gain and lose and gain, you're breaking that metabolism a little bit more and creating greater resistance and loss of flexibility in the body metabolically. So maybe what we should do a little bit now is talk about, so let's flesh this out. Like, what's really going on here? Why? I mean, it would be so much better. It would be so much easier.
It's true. I wish it worked long term.
It would be so much easier. Yeah. But I think, you know, let's dig into a little bit what you eat, when you eat. What are the other circumstances? Like, you know, the safety factor. Are you sleeping? Are you stressed? Like all of these things. But talking about food, like the what and the when has so much to do with the success or the resistance.
Yeah, exactly. So the goal is to lower cell inflammation, and that will balance the hormones, because we know every cell has these receptor sites for hormones. And when you have too much cell inflammation, it's going to be difficult for those hormones to attach to the cells and produce the job of burning fat, producing energy, et cetera. So we have to identify what has caused cellular inflammation. Once we are aware of that, we could work on removing it, which naturally will lower inflammation. Those hormones start to get into the cell, produce energy, burn fat. The weight starts to come off now as a side effect of getting healthy, which is the right way to do it, because it's actually sustainable. You're not wrecking the metabolism. You're actually supporting the metabolism. So the first half of the book goes into those main causes of cellular inflammation. One chapter talks about processed foods. And of course, we hear processed foods are not good for you. Eat whole foods. And yes, there are nuance there. There are some processed foods that are ultra processed foods. And I give some examples like a potato. When you go to the supermarket and buy a potato or a sweet potato, there's not an ingredient list for that, because it's what you see. It's a potato. But when you buy potato chips, there are tons of ingredients, 15, 20 different ingredients, seed oils, artificial ingredients in there. It's processed. There's a different response. It could be the same amount of calories, different hormonal response, different metabolic response with the processed potato chips versus the whole food potato. You could buy whole foods like an avocado, no ingredient list, eggs, no ingredient list. So simple thing is to just eat real food without that incredible long list of ingredients. There are some specific foods, though, that are more inflammatory than others.
I want to interrupt you for a second. Go back to the potato chip for a second, because, you know, big food is always getting smarter.
Yes.
And so now we have potato chips that have just three ingredients.
Yeah.
Potatoes, salt, and some kind of oil. And I just want to mention this because, you know, there's always going to be someone who's going to, there's always that kid that's finding the little loophole, right?
Yes.
And so the deep fried potato chip is not good for you. It doesn't matter if it has three ingredients.
Yeah.
It's a potato chip. So
it's still processed. Yeah, you're correct.
Still processed.
So even if it's fried in coconut
oil
or beef
coconut oil.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Same thing with French fries. We were hearing this craze about like French fries cooked in beef tallow, which is much better than
seed
oil.
But it's still a freaking French fry.
It's still a French fry. It's still high carb and high fat, which is not good. So you're correct. 100% correct.
So there are the healthy foods that are going to sabotage you. Anyway, I apologize for interrupting, but
no.
I felt like that had to be said, because it's out there.
You're correct. Now, if you're eating potato chips that have 20 ingredients in seed oils and you make that first step to the one that has three ingredients, it's a good transition.
Yep.
But it's not necessarily optimal, to your point.
It's not enough.
Yeah. You want to buy the potato, slice it up and bake it or something, right? That would be optimal if you choose to have potatoes. Let's talk about seed oils, because there's a lot of it's become mainstream, which is great and bad at the same time. And there's some conflicting information on seed oils. We see people in our space, this holistic health, alternative health space, saying that they're perfectly healthy for you. And they are right. Let me explain. There's a big difference between the studies showing that seed oils, there are studies showing seed oils are perfectly healthy, doesn't raise inflammation, supports cell membrane health. Yes, they can be when it's the unprocessed variety of seed oils.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I'm so glad you bring this up because the seed oil controversy, it's another one that crushes my soul a little
yes.
bit because I'm like, guys, let's be specific. Let's help people
yes.
understand. It's not a bad and good. Keep going.
Yes. It's about the way that it was processed, whether it was unprocessed or processed. I love omega-6 fats and seed oils when it's organic, cold pressed, never heated, amazing for inflammation, amazing for cell membrane health. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, almost, I don't know, I would estimate 95% of all of the seed oils out there are not that. They are processed. And those are highly inflammatory. Those yeah. stay in your body for years. The half-life is 680 days, meaning if you stopped eating them today, about 2 years later, half of them are still in your fat cells, cell membranes, mitochondrial membranes, creating inflammation. There's a study I put in the book, Metabolic Freedom, that shows, it was from Dr. Martin Grootfeld. He shows that French fries, speaking of French fries, he was reviewing French fries cooked in vegetable oil, and he was measuring the aldehyde contents produced after frying it. Aldehydes, of course, are carcinogenic, cancer-causing. When you smoke tobacco cigarettes, it also produces aldehydes. That's how tobacco cigarettes are linked to cancer. And he showed in the study that one French fry cooked in vegetable oil is equivalent to a tobacco cigarette smoked in terms of the aldehyde content produced. So let's unpack that real quick, Natalie, because
yeah, let's.
You could never smoke a tobacco cigarette. Amazing. But if you've had 10,000 French fries cooked in vegetable oil, it's like you've smoked 10,000 tobacco cigarettes. Okay, let's go a little bit further here. If you're giving your children French fries or chicken fingers, anything fried in vegetable oil, it's like you're giving them cigarettes with the aldehyde mm-hmm. content produced. So they're really inflammatory. They create massive amounts of cell membrane. They stay in your cell membranes for a long time. They're unstable fats. They're called polyunsaturated fatty acids. The word poly means many, so it contains many double bonds. That makes it unstable and reactive to oxygen, pressure, and heat. How do they process these oils? Oxygen, pressure, and heat, the exact things that make it unstable, not to mention it's bottled and then we fry it and refry it, in some cases refry it.
Yeah.
And it's oxidizing, it's embedding into our cells. So instead, we want to have saturated fats, the boogeyman fats, right? But these are stable. There are no double bonds. That's going to be coconut oil, butter, ghee, beef tallow. These are much, much healthier for you. And even monounsaturated fats like avocado oil and olive oil are much healthier for you.
Yeah, 100%. And I think what's also important for, and I'm loving this conversation. I think that what's also important for the audience to get their arms around is when we say saturated fats, we're not necessarily calling for people to guzzle buckets of saturated fat. And because I feel like these conversations go sideways so quickly. People assume that if you promote saturated fat, you're telling people, well, you can have as much as you want anytime. And I'd love you to address this because I've seen people fall apart on a high fat diet for a number of different, and a ketogenic diet. And I think one of the biggest mistakes people make, and we're going to talk about ketosis in a minute,
yeah.
but I think, you know, some of the biggest mistakes I see people making on keto diets is the dirty keto, which is where they're using, you know, processed fats and the wrong fats in the whole nine yards. But it's also that keto where they're not measuring and they're eating a really high fat diet. There's enough carbs sneaking in there that now they're on a high fat, high carb diet. Mm. Or for whatever reason, and this is me, I don't find fat. I can eat a lot of fat. I don't get satiated by it. I can eat butter until the cows come home. Guess what? I become a cow. So it's a funny thing how that works. We're not all the same. We don't all respond in the same way. And this is where we go back to that calorie model where calories in, calories out doesn't work. But you also don't get a free pass on how many calories, depending on you, your metabolism, and a whole bunch of other little factors in there. So do you want to talk a little bit, just as seed oils are not all bad in all ways, do you want to help the audience to kind of be a little more nuanced about saturated fats as well in this context?
Absolutely. Yeah, good point. And for being a cow, you're in the perfect environment.
Well, I'm not a cow anymore, but yeah, I can be. Like when I get my raw milk and I just chug it. I start growing.
That's good stuff. Yeah. That's why you're outside. Saturated fat. You made a good point. You don't want to consume saturated fat, especially a lot of saturated fat, with carbohydrates. That's the standard American diet, isn't it? It's a disaster. Yeah. There's something called the Randall cycle, and the Randall cycle will prioritize the carbohydrates and the sugar over the fat when you consume it at the same time. And then the fat stays in your bloodstream, raises your triglyceride levels, which is a marker for cardiovascular disease. And then it leads to LPS, which is a nasty free radical in your body, which is inflammatory. So yes, saturated fats are great, but there needs to be a limit. With keto, and we'll get into it a little bit later, you're right. People think it's a high-fat diet. It's a high-fat diet. That's one way. I'm not a fan of that approach. In the beginning, I do like increasing the fats as I decrease the carbs, and I'll talk more about that later. But overall, the protein is the focus when I talk about keto. Mm-hmm. And I reference getting the fat that comes with the protein, which is satiating. I'm curious, does protein satiate you?
To a point.
Okay.
To a point.
So you're unique. Most people, they get really satiated with protein.
I'm a funny little bird. That's all I can say.
But yeah, saturated fats are great. You don't want to overdo it. If you're going to increase it, do not increase it with high carbs. It works well when you increase saturated fats with very low carbohydrate, like a keto diet, but there needs to be a limit to your point.
Yeah. Okay. So let's jump into the keto diet, because I think that, and we're going to, just to give everybody, including you, a heads up, I want to talk keto diet. I want to talk about fasting.
Yeah.
And then I want to bust some myths and, hit some of those points that, makes us a little bit sad every time we hear it. So let's talk about ketosis and your approach, because there's definitely, it was really, really hot for a while. I mean, look, Atkins was the first guy, I think, that brought it up long, long time ago. It came raging back with Bulletproof. Mm-hmm. About, what was it, like 10 years ago now?
Yeah.
And it's kind of gone in waves ever since. And people can be very successful on a keto diet, but it remains very controversial. And with a lot of people talking about how it's a great intervention, it's a great thing to experience for the body to be able to use at times, but maybe is it possible that it's not the only way to be, and that maybe we're not achieving metabolic flexibility if we stay in ketosis all the time. So fire away.
Yeah. You said some really valuable points there that I agree with. Well, first of all, the way that I view ketosis is more of a metabolic process than a diet. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new about keto. It's just nuanced or new to some people. It did start to get popular, like you said, about 10 years ago. 2018, 2019 was like the peak of keto, and it's gone a little bit down, and carnivore has gone up, and the vegan diet's gone down, which is good news. So yes, every one of our ancestors used ketosis as a tool, a metabolic process, but they didn't use it forever. It's a great intervention, as you mentioned. Now, 93% of Americans are metabolically unhealthy. That mm-hmm. is according to a 2022 study. I call them in the book, they're in a keto deficiency, in a fat burning deficiency.
Nice.
They just simply forgot how to burn fat. They're stuck burning sugar. So for them, yeah, it's vital to get them into ketosis. Do we keep them there forever? No, I don't agree that we should do sustainable long-term ketosis, but we use it as an intervention, like you said, to achieve more metabolic flexibility. And then we flex back and forth from burning sugar to burning fat, which is the way that we're designed, right? Mm-hmm. But when you stay in ketosis long-term, like a lot of my colleagues in this keto space that I'm in, that's another variation of metabolic inflexibility. I'm not a fan of that. Carbs are not the enemy. They have its role. But for most people, yeah, I think it's a really valuable resource. The way that I teach it in the book is a 30-day plan at the end of the book, where I take them from burning sugar to burning fat in 7 days, which simply means I get you into ketosis safely in 7 days We pair it with intermittent fasting, which we'll talk about next. And then in that final week, we actually flex out of ketosis a couple times because I want to maintain metabolic flexibility. And that's what it's about. It's not about dogma or one diet. It's about flexibility. It's about metabolic freedom. So I think it's a valuable resource. I love ketosis. It's great for the mitochondria. It's great for the brain. It's great for conditions like insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes and PCOS. Amazing tool in the shed. Just know it's not the only tool in the shed. It's one tool in the shed that needs to be used the right way.
Yeah, I love that. And the paradox is that as much as it can improve your insulin sensitivity in the short term, overused, it can actually lead to insulin resistance.
Yeah.
And that's a point that I think, and you know, when you hear people come tell you, you know, like they're so, it's like they've been sold a bill of goods. Like, I've been so good. I've been in ketosis. It worked for me so well. And now all of a sudden, if I so much as like give a look at something that's higher carb, my body goes into a tailspin. Mm. And what's happened is it's gone back. It's turned back and bit them, where they've now become insulin resistant. And this is why metabolic freedom, metabolic flexibility, being the central tenet of what you talk about and do is so important. It's so important for people to understand we need to be able to do both.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me explain that a little bit more, because you're spot on about this insulin resistance. It's a different form of insulin resistance than typical insulin resistance with long-term continuous ketosis. The analogy is this. It's like, this is funny because the analogy is based off of your background kind of, but let's say you live in the middle of the woods, like Natalie, in a cabin in Alaska, and it's the summer. So the weather's nice. It's nice and warm, but you know, in a few months, it's going to be fall and winter and it's going to be super cold. You don't have anything to heat the cabin. So you need to store firewood. So you store, let's say, 20 logs of firewood, not that much, by winter time. And winter rolls around and you know, look, there's going to be 4 or 5 months of cold weather, but you only have 20 logs of firewood. What are you going to do? You're going to burn that firewood as slowly as possible to preserve your precious fuel supply. Look, this is similar to when you do long-term ketosis. Think of your body fat as the firewood. And if you're only burning fat, this is your precious fuel supply. You're not burning sugar, any other substrate. You're going to slow down the burning of that body fat. So it actually leads to slowed weight loss. Your innate intelligence literally sends a signal to insert water into your cells, and it blunts those receptor sites for insulin, creating a different insulin resistance process. If your friend saw that you only had 20 logs of firewood and said, oh my gosh, Natalie, you only have 20 logs of firewood. I have thousands. I'm going to dump 200 logs of firewood for you to use. Now, what are you going to do? You're going to be more inspired to ramp up the burning. Same thing when you introduce a higher healthy carb day, what I call a metabolic flex day. You remind the metabolism it's not starving. You go from burning fat to burning sugar, and it breaks a plateau, prevents a plateau, and helps you prevent this different type of insulin resistance. That's why we want to maintain this metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, I love that. So you just mentioned a carb day. So, which leads me to my next question is, when you talk about cycling ketosis, are you cycling, like, are you doing a season? Because there's different schools of thought out there, right? There's a school of thought that says, if we were to follow ancestral patterns, we would eat, you know, all the foods while there are plenty, which is in the summertime. And there's even a theory that I've heard that by the time fall and winter rolled around, people were literally borderline type 2 diabetics. Like they'd been stuffing themselves, but then the winter came.
Yeah.
And they would burn through those stores and they'd get into fasting and they'd get into ketosis. And if they would, they would just lean out over the winter, and then the spring would come and the summer would come and they'd start all over again. And so there was this, these would have been very long cycles,
yeah,
of ketosis and then not ketosis. So ketosis being more appropriate in the wintertime, and the summertime being that time when you're replenishing those stores kind of thing, which assumes you want to get fat and skinny and skinny and fat and fat and skinny, which, you know, we all know not the best plan for a number, yeah, of reasons. But from an ancestral perspective, there seemed to be some wisdom in that for the human body. But when you're talking now about cycling, are you talking about cycling days within the week, or are you talking about cycling months, or what's your recommendation for modern life? Because we don't live in those days anymore, yeah. By the way.
Yeah, this is true. It's a great idea to follow ancestral seasonal eating. I think it makes a lot of sense. Is it realistic and practical and doable for most people? Not really. Even me, I don't do that, but it is one option if you want to do that. You know, hats off to you. But
you need two wardrobes. I mean, you need everything. Yeah. I mean,
you're going to be a different person half of the year. You could go out to dinner on a Friday in December and say, what are you doing eating those carbs? It's winter. Don't you know it's winter? You could be that person. No.
You could be that person.
Weekly is the answer. That's what I teach. It's what I personally do. Give you an example. What I currently do with my routine is Monday through Saturday, I am primarily carnivore keto, where I'm eating mostly meat and fat. And then Sunday is my metabolic flex day, where I actually increase my carbohydrate intake to 300, sometimes 400 grams of carbs in a day.
Wow.
Healthy whole food carbs. I lower my fat on that day, because I explained earlier how you want to lower fat on a high carb day. Mm-hmm. And I get the protein that I need to get. So that's one way to do it. You can have one day per week where you flex out. You could have 2 days per week where you flex out. Well, it depends on how healthy your metabolism is, but I do like a weekly approach. And you could kind of time those flex days, which are also feast days, not cheat days, but feast days, with like an event or a wedding or somewhere where you know you're going to be able to have access to more carbohydrates than what you're used to. So I like the weekly approach, Natalie.
Yeah, no, I love that. And by the way, guys, your body doesn't really know the day. So it could be a Wednesday. It could be a Thursday.
Correct.
It could be,
yeah.
Really, I mean, find the day that really works for you. And you're very good friends. And I think he may have been a mentor of yours at some time, is Dr. Pompa. And
yeah.
I went to one of his conferences way
That's
back.
That's right. Was it Atlanta?
I think you were there. And he brought Mindy Pels up on stage mm-hmm. at that time and said, this woman is doing amazing things. And
yeah.
She was just getting started. And he was the first one who I heard articulate this idea of a feast day and a fast day. The way he outlined the week was just so beautiful, because you had your, almost like your 5 days of this is what you do, right? And you would be eating very low carb, and I do want you to go into what a ketogenic diet looks like for you. You said earlier, like maybe it's a little bit more protein, not quite as much fat. Like, I'd love you to explain that a bit to the audience. And then he had a fast day and a feast day.
Yeah.
And the logic, which is perfect when you hear it, it makes so much sense. It's, you're keeping the body guessing. The body yeah. never feels like we're about to die of famine, so we better hang on to everything we've got. Like, it's kind of like keeping the body in a place of flux. Well, a flexibility, really.
Yeah.
Keeping it flexible.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. Dr. Pompa, he is still my mentor. I love that man. He's changed my life. He endorsed the book. Mindy wrote the foreword for the book, Dr. Mindy Pell.
She did?
Pell. Yeah.
Oh, look at you guys. I love it.
And that's his 5-1-1 rule that you're referring to. It's a 7-day protocol, 5 days, intermittent fasting, 18-6, keto, 1 day, 24-hour fast, 1 day, flex day. That's a great, great protocol. It works really well. There's different ways to do it as well. He's right. And you mentioned the personal trainer at the beginning. Every great personal trainer, fitness coach understands the concept of muscle confusion, right? You, mm-hmm. you keep changing the workout routine, high reps, low weight, different routine. The body keeps adapting. You keep getting results. You don't plateau. Same thing with this approach. It creates this metabolic confusion, as I talk about in the book, where you don't adapt. You're constantly adapting. You're not reaching homeostasis. So you don't plateau, you upregulate hormones. It works really well. We're so habitual, where we eat the same foods, follow the same fasting schedule over and over and over. That's not a good idea. Eventually your body will reach homeostasis and plateau. So variation, Dr. Pompa calls it diet variation. That is the key.
If you're over 35, there's a really good chance that your enzyme levels have already begun to decline. And that is not good news. However, there isn't an easy solution for this. digestive enzymes. Enzymes are the workhorses of digestion. They break your food down into usable macro and micronutrients. And who the heck doesn't want to get more nutrients out of the food they're already eating? Research shows that by the time people hit 65, their saliva and pancreatic secretions, both of which are involved in enzyme activity, can have declined by as much as 50%. And this decline creates chronic indigestion, setting the stage for gut issues, yeast and mold overgrowth, even malnutrition. But listen up, guys. Even if you're not over 65, enzyme depletion is incredibly common. And if you have gas, bloating, indigestion, you feel heavy after meals, there's a really good chance that your enzyme secretion is not up to par. And that can be for a number of reasons, from either excess sugar, processed foods, alcohol, or coffee consumption, stress. Anybody stressed these days? Low zinc levels, dehydration, all of these things can contribute to low enzyme production. Now, this is why I'm a huge fan of enzyme supplementation. And the best enzyme formula I've ever found comes from my friends at Bioptimizers called Masszymes. Masszymes is the most complete, most potent digestive enzyme formula I've ever seen or experienced, with over 102% more protease than their nearest competitor. And this is crucial because protein is the most complex macronutrient to break down. Left undigested, hang on to your hats, protein putrefies in the gut and creates a variety of problems from bloating to inflammation and beyond. No, thank you. So these days I use Masszymes when I eat every single meal, and I'll take 2 capsules with a smaller meal. I'll take up to 5 capsules with bigger meals. I especially use a Masszymes when I'm eating sushi. Now, you can try Masszymes for yourself at bioptimizers.com/bionat. And make sure to enter coupon code BIONAT to get 10% off your order. Okay, let's talk a little bit about intermittent fasting, because I've seen it certainly in my practice, things that I've seen where intermittent fasting can be extremely powerful. But one of the things I've seen is that people sometimes overdo it.
Yes.
And do you want to talk about, I want to talk about 2 things coming up. I want to talk about the intermittent fasting, how to do it right, and how to avoid getting caught in that trap where it's just so freaking convenient that you do it all the time. And yeah. Then, right? Because that's what happens to people. And then the converse, which is eating a little meal every 2.5 hours a day.
Oh, yeah. So this is good because this is fresh on my mind. This morning I recorded a solo podcast on, what is it titled? 3 gigantic intermittent fasting mistakes I've made over the years. And
perfect.
Perfect for this, right? So so first let's understand this. Fasting is a stress to the body. Mm-hmm. However, what drives me crazy, Nat, is when I hear practitioners say, women should never fast. Because it's stressful, too stressful on their body. It's a stress to the body. That would be the equivalent to saying women should never exercise because it's stress on the body, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about the stress. It's about, are they adapting to the stress?
Right.
If you adapt to a stress like a fast, it is absolutely incredible for both men and women. It upregulates all these amazing processes, autophagy, human growth hormone, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. You lower inflammation, you burn fat, you feel good. If you don't adapt to the stress, like doing too much, I'm guilty of that in the past.
Yeah.
You lose all those benefits. Yeah, right? We all have, because we fall in love with something and we think more is
like,
better.
Oh my God, this is amazing. I'm just going to do this forever.
More. I'm never going to eat. I'm going to live in the woods like Natalie.
I'm going to be a breatharian.
Exactly. Let's not get there.
Yeah, let's not go there.
So what happens is this is hormesis, right? When you apply a stress and adapt to it, you stay in this hermetic zone. When you don't adapt to it, you lose the benefits. So it's really a question of, are you adapting to fasting? Here's how you know. You could test your blood glucose and blood ketones during a fast. And if you see it, if you see your glucose drop throughout the fast and your ketones rise, that's a great sign. It's showing metabolic flexibility. It's showing you're adapting to it. That is good. But if you see your glucose increase during a fast and ketones be non-existent, that could be a sign that it's too much of a stress for you. And you might want to shorten the fasting window, do more feasting for right now. You could also look at heart rate variability as a gauge to see if that fast is working for you or against you. If you see it drop below your baseline, You might be doing too much fasting. Fasting is catabolic. That could be a good thing because it's that cellular repair, that autophagy, but too much of that, you lose muscle, weaken the immune system. It's just too much. You're not getting enough protein. The opposite of fasting, of course, is feasting. It's this growth phase, this mTOR, mechanistic target of rapamycin phase, where you're growth. And that's really important in spurts, but they work in opposite ends. If mTOR is activated, autophagy is deactivated, and vice versa. The magic is in both. The magic is in the feast, the famine, right? What we were talking about with Dr. Pompa. What I see with the biggest mistake people make with fasting is they go from being a sugar burner, somebody who's eating every 2 to 3 hours, 300 grams of carbs per day, and then they go into an 18-hour fast. That's like running a marathon without training for it. It's going to be ugly. You're going to break down muscle.
Like heck.
Yeah, you're going to lower glucose in the brain. The brain's going to panic, send you intense signals for craving. So you want to build up that fasting muscle, lower the carbs a little bit, first eliminate the snacks in between meals, and then start building up the fasting window. Start with 12 hours and go to 14, go to 16, and then see if your body's adapting to that stressor. And if it is, you could stay there or increase the window. And if you're not, you do more feasting, more building up, more mTOR.
I love it. And what about this little fairy tale that you have to eat every 2.5 hours to keep your metabolism active, firing, or whatever? I don't even remember.
Revved up, fired up. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it is a fairy tale. It's a good way to explain it. I'll say this. If you want to age faster than anybody you know, eat every 2-3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's healthy, like you're raising glucose and insulin, you're starting the digestive system. You will age yourself rapidly. There's something called the Hayflick limit, mm-hmm. which states your cells could duplicate and duplicate a certain amount of times until it cannot. Then it turns into a senescent cell, which then infects other cells, which ages you. There are immunosenescent cells, zombie cells, some people call it. And the more you eat and raise glucose, the faster those cells duplicate. When you eat frequently, you're getting this happening, this process of the Hayflick limit will get there much, much faster. So it's not a good idea. Again, we're not even looking to rev up the metabolism. We're looking for a flexible, healthy metabolism. And on the point of metabolism, Natalie, I want to share a study that I put in the book. This is probably the most comprehensive study ever done on the metabolism. And I looked at a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, I've heard so many people say, my metabolism is so slow. Or once I hit age 50, my metabolism slowed down. How do I fix my slow metabolism? And the study was from Duke University, and it was published in 2021. It was done on 6,600 people, and it was a worldwide study, involved multiple countries. It took these 6,600 people from all different age ranges, from age 1, believe it or not, all the way to age 95 and everything in between. And it used the gold standard for testing metabolic or metabolism, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what the study said. It said, there are no significant changes in the metabolism between ages 20 and 60.
Oh. There goes that excuse, guys.
Oh. But let me finish. No significant changes between 20 and 60. So no excuses there. Mm-hmm. You don't have a slow metabolism. Something else is going on. And it said, once you reach age 60, they notice a 0.7% decline in the metabolism every year after. And you're thinking, damn, that's bad news. Here's the good news. The study said the only reason, or I should say the main reason that happens is because loss of muscle mass.
Yes.
So if you are 30, 40, 50 right now and you're building lean muscle mass and preserving it, or if you're 60, 70 and you're building lean muscle mass,
mm-hmm.
the great news is this. You could be 75 years old and have the same metabolism as when you were 25 years old. Building muscle mass is crucial, and that's why I was asking you for some peptide tips early on.
Yeah. No, building muscle mass is virtually the holy grail of everything that we're talking about here. Right. And if you're listening to this podcast and you're in your 20s or your 30s, even in your 40s, but definitely in your 20s and your 30s, these are your building years.
Oh,
this
yes.
is, it will never be easier for you to build muscle, and for women, even men, to also like build, investing in that bone bank account. Like you, this is when you want to be building that stuff. Like, don't sit around thinking you can do it later. You can do it later, but it's a heck of a lot harder.
Yeah.
So thank you for popping that metabolism slows down with age bubble for us.
Yeah, it's Ben. BS.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
In your opinion, do you think that there are people who should not use ketosis as a strategy and maybe instead should use a less extreme approach like a low glycemic diet? Like, I don't think that being in a high carb state all the time, to your point, is a good idea. But do you think there's people that maybe a ketogenic diet just isn't right for them? Do you have any thoughts on that? I don't know if you talk about it in the book, but I'm curious about your opinion because you've studied this so deeply.
Well, if you're pregnant, breastfeeding, under 18, these are probably, it's not a good idea to be in a ketogenic state in ketosis. Outside of that, I think it's valuable for every human being. Now, with that being said, it doesn't have to be keto, right? Keto is very low carb. Mm-hmm. For 93% of Americans, yeah, I think you need to use that for some time. But yeah. there's some people that don't have to bring their carbs that low. It could be a variation of it, to your point. It could be a low carb diet, which is, let's say, 100 to 150 grams of carbs, like a paleo diet, and get a lot of benefits, especially when you're active, especially when you have muscle mass. There's really no need to drop that low.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you have a subset of people that I think really need it. So to answer your question, not everybody needs to use it. Most people will really benefit from it, especially those with metabolic dysfunction. Yeah. And the more muscle mass you have, the more active you are, the more carbohydrates you could have and be insulin sensitive. So there's some ways to work around this.
Yeah, no, that's so true. And I think it's going back to that metabolic flexibility, because those people that are super active, that are carrying a lot of lean muscle, they are metabolically flexible.
Yes.
Right. And they're probably the ones that can actually flip into fat burning faster than the less metabolically flexible people. Like, for example, if you're an endurance athlete, you're most likely going to flip into fat burning at some point.
Yeah. And what's happening, people think that's a really good point, because people think in order to be in ketosis, you're eating a very low carbohydrate diet or eating high fat. Yes, that is true in some cases, but you could also, if you're really metabolically flexible, you could, let's say, have 200 grams of carbs a day, which is not low enough to enter ketosis, but you have enough lean muscle mass, you're very active, and let's say you're done eating at 6 p.m., you go to bed, wake up, and don't eat until, like, let's say 7 a.m., so 13 hours without food, you're probably in ketosis at that point before you break the fast. So you're probably going in and out just naturally because you're so metabolically flexible.
Yeah. And let's just qualify. This is not you unless you are an athlete. You are metabolically flexible.
Yes.
Just if you're listening to this and all you heard was 300 grams of carbs or 200, whatever it was you said, 200 grams of 200. Carbs.
Yeah.
Stop eating at 6, wake up in the morning and eat at 7. And you're like, oh, I could do that. I'm so in. No, there are qualifiers to that.
Yeah. And yeah. So, you're probably not Ben Greenfield. So I don't know.
No, he's one of the few people who can probably get away with that. There just aren't that many around. Okay. So how many of you have already bought the book just listening to this? Because I'm telling you, this book is important. It's even got a 30-day plan in it, which, you know, this is classic Ben Azadi. This is the guy. He's going to lay it all out for you, and then he's going to help you to do it, which is, that's just who you are. You're that guy. You're the best host. You're the hostess with the mostest.
Thank you. I appreciate you. So
let's do a little bit of myth busting here.
Oh, yeah.
Let's talk about what's one popular health food that's secretly spiking people's insulin all day
long. Oh, yeah. Well, oatmeal, I would say oatmeal. First of all, oatmeal is typically loaded with glyphosate, which is, of course, a weed killer and mitochondrial poison. And people think that oatmeal is not sugar. And technically, it's not. But when you eat it, it turns into sugar. So we think oatmeal is healthy, but it is spiking your blood sugar. If you don't believe me, throw on a continuous glucose monitor or a finger prick and watch what happens 2 hours after eating it.
It doesn't take 2 hours. I'm here to tell you.
Okay.
I mean, I will eat some oats, but right after a heavy weightlifting.
That's the best time to do it. Yep.
Right. And so there's some caveats, right? If you're dying for that high carb food, not that I want to call it earning it, but there are times when your body will be better able to cope with it
yep.
than others.
Whey protein is one of those times. So whey protein is very, very, very insulinogenic. Huge insulin response. I'm not against whey protein when you have it after a workout when you're highly insulin sensitive. It's a great thing to have. If you're doing whey protein after a workout, if you're just doing it throughout the day, it's doing more damage than it is helping you.
100%. As a matter of fact, that should be, that might be part of your muscle building program, Ben.
Ah, there you go.
That whey protein, well-timed whey protein might actually be a really nice thing for you.
I like that idea.
Yeah. Besides, it's really yummy. Okay. So what is one thing that that someone could start doing right now to start themselves on the path towards healing their metabolism?
Well,
if you need them.
What did you say?
I said you can have two things if you need it.
No, I have one thing. I have one thing. So I know you kind of mentioned it earlier, but I think your audience may have forgotten. So don't give it away when I talk about it now. It's a supplement. This is called vitamin G. So vitamin G, it's anti-inflammatory. It helps with brain fog, helps with fat loss, helps with autoimmune conditions. UC Davis has some really great studies showing that individuals who take vitamin G have healthier blood pressure levels, healthier blood sugar levels. JAMA, this is really cool. Nat, JAMA published a study in Harvard that I put in the book. It's a new study. It's the most comprehensive study ever done on vitamin G. 49,275 nurses in this study. What a study.
Wow.
And they said in the study, the nurses that took daily doses of vitamin G had a 9% reduction in dying from all-cause mortality and a 15% reduction in dying from cardiovascular disease versus the nurses who didn't take vitamin G. Studies show when you take vitamin G, you have healthier mitochondria as well. Vitamin G is not a sponsor of the podcast. We don't have an affiliate link for vitamin G because, as Natalie knows, vitamin G is the feeling of gratitude, not the practice. I used to say practice. It's not the practice. It's the feeling of gratitude. All of those studies are on gratitude. When I saw you lecture a few weeks ago at the Biohacker Expo, you talked about vitamin J, which is joy and gratitude.
Well, I only created that after I heard about vitamin J.
Yes.
I'm like, oh, I love my it, God, though. There's a whole series of them.
Yeah, there is. I love it, but this is serious. Like when you are intentional with your gratitude, it will change your entire life. It'll rewire your brain. It'll downregulate your sympathetic nervous system. And it's free, no upper limit. You get an immediate benefit. So if you're not feeling gratitude every day, add that into your arsenal.
Yeah. And I just want to say to people, you know, and people might be sitting there going, look, I'm going through a really hard time. Like my job is crappy. My relationships are up in smoke and, you know, the economy is going to hell in a handbasket and blah, blah, blah. I would encourage you to really listen to what Ben said, and that is feeling gratitude. Can you find a tiny little thing that you can feel gratitude for? It could be that I feel so grateful that I was able to have a hot shower this morning.
Yeah.
I feel so grateful that I had a chance to listen to this podcast. I feel so grateful that my shoes aren't falling apart. Anything. It doesn't have to be big, because what the studies showed was literally just having that thought, going through the process of experiencing any kind of gratitude for any little thing. It's almost like it starts the wheel moving in a better direction, and then it'll just start to build over time. Yeah. So I love that. And I would close there, except I have more questions for you. So we're going to keep going.
Well said, though. You're absolutely correct.
Why do you think that so many people gain weight back after doing keto? Like, we've seen the people who did keto, they lost a bunch of weight, and then they gain weight. They gain it back somehow. I mean, people just tend to regain weight after they lose it. And I have my ideas about this, but I think, and we probably talked about it earlier, actually. We talked about this earlier. And I'm just going to invite you to share your thoughts on that. Basically, it's when keto goes wrong.
Yeah. Well, my answer is actually going to be different than probably what you think. First of all, yes, what we talked about earlier about too long in ketosis and not maintaining metabolic flexibility, that is part of the answer there. But I think more than that, chapter 10 of my book is my favorite chapter. It's how your thoughts influence your metabolism and longevity or disease. And I will probably write my next book all about chapter 10 and call it Mental Freedom. I've been thinking about that. But in that chapter 10, I talk about this concept called the self-image, which is the way we view ourselves. Mm. And I reference a book called Psycho-Cybernetics from the 1960s. Dr. Maxwell Maltz wrote the book. He called this the greatest physiological discovery of his generation. Maxwell Maltz was a world-renowned plastic surgeon. And his patients would be individuals who had these really wicked facial disfigurements, and they were unhappy. They were self-conscious. And in some cases, they were depressed because of the way they looked. So they would hire Maxwell Maltz to perform plastic surgery and remove the facial disfigurements. And what Maxwell Maltz noticed is that even after the surgeries, nothing changed. They were still self-conscious. They were still depressed. They were still unhappy. They would literally look in the mirror and see themselves with the facial disfigurement, even though it wasn't there, because that's what their self-image was of themselves. Mm. It wasn't until you changed their self-image that everything changed for them. To your question, when our self-image is an obese person, an overweight person, we make a conscious decision to change and do keto, whatever it is, and we lose the weight. But if we never change the self-image and it still identifies as an overweight person, you can never outperform the self-image. You will find a way to sabotage yourself and gain the weight back to match that self-image. So I think a lot of people who get one step forward, two steps back, this is what's happening to them. You got to change the self-image. I talk about how to do that in chapter 10, but essentially it's the constant spaced repetition of this new idea. You literally write it down, and I give you a specific thing to write down. It's part of the 30-day plan, actually, until you say it enough times that it replaces the old image in your subconscious mind, then you become unstoppable.
Wow. I love that you just said that. And the subconscious mind, you know, its job is purely to deliver on what you believe.
Exactly. Whatever you feed it, whether it's real or imagined.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to finish one last question before we wrap it up. Men and women, does it work the same for boys as it does for girls, this ketogenic diet?
No, it doesn't. I'm sorry, ladies.
Sorry. Not sorry. So, yeah. That was a leading question. Yes. And.
Yeah. No, it's not the same. Fasting's not the same either for men and women. And women who are going through their menstrual cycle years versus postmenopause are also different. Men will get better results, faster results. I'm sorry. Women are different, right? We know that women, women who have a menstrual cycle versus men, very different hormonal cycle. Us men are on a 24-hour cycle. Menstruating women are on a 28-day cycle, and there's a difference there. So women need to flex out more.
Yeah.
Women who are in their postmenopausal years need to focus more on stress reduction techniques, adrenal support, because of course the ovaries have shut down and the adrenals pick up the slack. You know all about this. Well, so it is different for men versus women. So if you're working with the practitioner teaching you keto and they're not telling you this, that's a red flag. It needs to be applied differently. I talk about this in the book, talk about different hormones in the book that are at play here for men versus women. So yeah, that's the bad news. But the good news is now that you know the truth, you could customize your approach to work for you, not against you.
I love it. Ben, we could keep talking I could sit here and talk to you for the rest of the day.
I love chatting with you. We always have fun.
I think it should have been the Metabolic Bible, personally, but you know, that's just me.
The Metabolic Bible. Wow.
First of all, thank you so much for taking the time. I know that you're running hard these days. Getting the book out there and helping people to find it and find you. But please, so first of all, thank you for taking the time. And where can people find you as you're dashing from one place to another?
Yeah, no.
And how can they get their hands on the book?
Yeah, same thing for you. I know that you're all over the place. So thank you for making the time to talk about this to your audience.
Always.
I'm very grateful. I can't wait to share another stage with you soon.
Same.
The book's called Metabolic Freedom. It's available on hardcover, Audible, and Kindle. I narrated the Audible. Mindy Pels wrote the foreword, and it's out May 13th, which this is coming out the week of, I think, right?
I'm not sure about that, but okay. we'll be right around there.
Yeah, right around the time of this release. And we have a gift for your audience to get the book, whether it's a pre-order or the week of an order. It's a free course on the metabolism with 12 lessons that I built out with exclusive interviews in that course with Dr. Jason Fung, Dr. Daniel Pompa, who we mentioned earlier, Cynthia Thurlow and Megan Ramos. Wow. You could only find that in the course. It's completely free. I'm not collecting a credit card and charging you later. No, you get all that for free, but you got to go to metabolicfreedombook.com to order it. There's different retailers. Any of those are fine. And then you place your email, name, and order number, and you're instantly sent the course with the interview. So it's metabolicfreedombook.com.
Okay. I love it. Don't wait, folks. Be the first to get it.
Get it. And chapter 10.
Chapter 10. If you read nothing else, chapter 10.
Exactly. But read it all. But yes.
And read it all. Okay. What about social media? Now you're on YouTube.
Yes.
And you're on social media. So.
Yeah. The Ben Azadi. So the Ben Azadi on social media, not because I have an ego trip, but somebody else took Ben Azadi. And
besides, you are the Ben Azadi.
Thank you. That's also my YouTube is just Ben Azadi on YouTube. And then my website is benazadi.com.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Azadi, thank you so much. And as you said, I cannot wait to see you again and to share a stage.
I can't wait, Natalie. You're doing great work and good job getting outside and getting sunshine during the conversation.
Thank you. If anybody's listening to the podcast, just head over to YouTube and you'll
you'll know what we're talking about.
Thanks so much, Ben.